Where do I begin?
Matt is the one who had the audacity to respond to my Instagram story.
So I guess I did this to myself, but there's a couple topics, specifically the monetization of celebrity deaths and the avoidance of artist mental health and whether or not troubled artists create better music.
A quote I really like from Rick Rubin's book. He says, one of the reasons so many great artists die of overdoses early in their lives is because they're using drugs to numb a very painful existence. The reason it's painful is the reason they became artists in the first place, their incredible sensitivity. So he draws a connection between basically what it takes to make art, which is being able to observe your surroundings in a very, very deep way to read meaning into everything in life. But that's also what causes people to read too much meaning into life and to take everything very seriously, to internalize a lot of negative emotions as well as a lot of positive emotions.
This is interesting. Sensitive people, because I think it was in the 90s when the first psychologist actually coined the term highly sensitive person, which is sort of a hidden variable to the whole tortured artist versus mental health grand debate, right? Because there are people that one of their personality traits, like, they call it highly sensitive people, but there's not really any actual diagnostic way of figuring out if you're a highly sensitive person, but it's pretty much just characterized by somebody who is sensitive to sensory experiences and stimuli, which can encompass a whole bunch of different things. For one, if you're a highly sensitive person, you're more likely to have a mental health issue, and you're also more likely to become an artist. So that's one of the bridges, I think, between the intersectionality between the two.
But what's the trait, what's the main factor of highly sensitive? Say someone's a highly sensitive person, but what does that mean?
Well, so they're kind of still developing that. There's not really much that we even know, especially since everything that we know can very quickly be rearranged by any new piece of seemingly irrelevant information. That's kind of how the study of the human mind is. But being a highly sensitive person essentially means that you are more reactive and sensitive to physical, social, emotional, mental stimuli. People who are autistic that have sensory processing disorders, people who have ADHD who are also, you know, have issues being overstimulated or understimulated. But it doesn't even necessarily have to branch into a disorder either. Sometimes people are just, they are more sensitive to different experiences. It can be physical. People who have issues watching scary movies or violence in movies. People that are extra perceptive with art pieces, that get moved emotionally by it. People that have really deep-rooted empathy and get compassionate burnout. Those people tend to be highly sensitive people. People that have had some sort of trauma too have also in some ways are hypersensitive to those things. But a lot of it really is just that we're finding that certain people are just born being more sensitive and receptive to stimuli. We just receive more stimulus input. And so those people are more likely to outsource and find an output for all of this stimulus overload.
Well, there's also how, like, you actually process this. Like, you were talking about scary movie stuff. I've been with people who I've watched a scary movie and it's actually scared me. I've been like, that was a phenomenal movie because it actually scared me. And they're like, that was a bad movie. I'm like, why? They're like, because that was too scary. I'm like, well, that's why we were watching the movie, was it not? And it's also, yeah, can come to, I mean, that is what leads the input of stimulus into how you output it. Of, did that actually, like, scare you? And do you define that as you're happy you got this overstimulation, or are you upset you got this overstimulation? And I feel people who like the overstimulation to an extent, then start to try to output it because they enjoyed what the input was.
Chasing a rush.
Uh-huh. That's like the mental version of an adrenaline junkie. There are people who go like bungee jumping and are like, not miss me with that. That was too much.
That weak shit.
Mm-hmm. And there are people who get the exact same feeling from it, but are like, oh yeah, that's the exact reason I like that.
Right. Well, when you hear people refer to themselves as being an empath, a lot of times that's also what that means too. Just somebody that's being more sensitive to sensory input.
Mm-hmm. If I ever have someone tell me they're an empath, I'm immediately going to know they're not.
It's a red flag. Yeah.
That means you're a narcissist.
There's a lot of ways to cope with being extra sensitive. And one of the ways is to shut off that sensitivity hard. Like that's one of the reasons depression manifests very differently in a lot of people. In some cases, depression is actually a lack of input. It's like less stimulation in response to stimuli. You look at a beautiful sunset and it doesn't do anything. Or conversely, there's types of depression or phases of bipolar depression where you're more sensitive to everything and the negative emotions are overwhelming. And so as a response, you need to distance yourself from what you're feeling. You need to dissociate.
I'm curious how much self-awareness plays into all these things, because I've always I don't know which way it goes, but it's like a high level of self-awareness I think plays into a lot of what becomes a disorder. I can't justify that for all of them, but at least in my own experiences of being a person, I feel that a lot of, like a high level of self-awareness kind of plays into the way my brain works, that people would say ADD, or why am I so anxious, you know? I can't help but think that that's part of what could be a factor that would play into a highly sensitive person. At least in a lot of cases, it makes sense to me. I don't know. It's like self-awareness, I feel, usually has a significant amount of empathy as well. Not something you develop, but something you have. But just in the way of empathizing with certain parts of the world and not empathizing with certain parts of the world, I don't know. I think that very much plays into the kind of mindset in a person that just sees the world in a different way, and those are the people who are generally artists.
Mental health also, there's a complete difference between the total population of people that have mental health disorders versus the demographics of people that actually get diagnosed. And I think part of the correlations between artists having higher rates of mental illness is that self-awareness that you were talking about, when your entire passion is based off of vulnerable expressions. And a lot of artists specifically have a reputation, and their art is their negative emotions. It's their darkest, most vulnerable parts that they have to be very honest with themselves with, right? Artists are more likely to disclose mental illness than I think most other populations are in that way, which is what contributes to it being a myth, right? Because
to disclose it?
Yeah, right. Disclosing it either,
what do you mean?
Either A, just being self-aware to the point where they're getting a diagnosis for it, or B, coping in a way that's very public and so that everybody can see it.
So you mean they consider it a fact?
At least other people do, because there's also the belief in art as self-expression. There's a lot of wanting to dive into the mind state of the artist. That's really what a lot of people are fixated on. And so if an artist has these sorts of problems that get thrown in the DSM, people are more likely to find those, in addition to artists being more likely to talk about that as part of their thing, versus like no one cares if an athlete has depression. Because also they're going to be crippled in like 4 years.
A Wall Street broker, depression,
Just assume you're self-medicating depression with cocaine and then move on.
Yeah, you're a politician. No one cares about your PTSD unless you're using it as like a running tool, but...
Yeah, but artists, that's a selling point, is what's going on in their head.
It's romanticized a lot, especially when people that have a lot of trauma and they're able to give people the experience of being able to empathize with an emotion without experiencing it directly. I think that that's part of what makes everybody besides the tortured artists so attached to the trope too, right? You don't have to lose somebody in a horrific car crash to be able to feel through art how awful that must have been for the person that experienced it.
Well, and that's why as I've said repeatedly, why I like disturbing media is because I can control my feeling of this emotion that should probably never really be experienced ideally. But I get to control, like, how I feel negative emotions. That's why consumption of disturbing art, I feel, can be therapeutic.
And, well, and, you know, so many artists, like, a lot of the famous ones that we know now are actually bipolar, too. So there's that also added part where there's getting into a creative flow can also be manic episodes. Mariah Carey has bipolar disorder. Vincent van Gogh almost definitely had bipolar disorder just based off of historical accounts.
Thelonious Monk is common. It's very common.
I think there's some sort of fundamental bipolar aspect to the creation of art. You need to feel something very intensely, very powerfully, and usually something that's hard to express in words, that's hard to process immediately. And then later, you need to be able to put that into the language of your medium. So there's the act of perception, of internalizing feelings. There's a process of learning to communicate them, of learning to conceptualize them, and it's a translation back. And that's why I think a lot of artists, even if they don't have bipolar disorder as diagnosable, they have some bipolar aspect to their personality that allows them to make this switch between pure perception and pure communication.
My thing on that would be, if you're an artist, I mean, the entire function of art is to create a thing that brings emotion. I feel, can we theoretically agree, like, art is just a representation of emotion. Art that doesn't spark emotion doesn't do anything, period. It exists.
Yes, it's a representation of life, of real life.
And so if you're an artist and you are 100% of the time on the emotion side, like just the emotion of your output is the only thing that exists to you, you're going to go insane and die so early, because that is not a thing you can have on all the time. It's like a banker doesn't go home and then start banking even more, except, I mean, some do, but like...
That's a sign of a problem.
Yeah, that's an issue. So that's why bipolar artists are normally the ones who tend to be able to go more, because they're able to, either whether they choose to or not choose to, purposely get fully invested into a thing, a piece of emotion that's just an output, and then able to not be invested, ideally, and have a second of they're entirely on a different wave or different feeling.
The experience of, again, being a hypersensitive person and feeling sensory experiences that a lot of people can't feel so deeply. Sometimes it's not necessarily just emotion, but I think that being receptive to stimuli is extremely imperative to being able to create art that other people relate with.
Yeah.
I think what distinguishes art from a lot of other things is that it goes beyond just something that you can really talk about. It's something that you feel either deeply and emotionally or in some other sort of physiological or weird brain scratchy twisty way.
When I talk about art, I like to think of it in terms of partially emotion, but largely affect, which is like the physiological precursor to emotion. And then emotion, what it technically is how we interpret sense stimulus. Another way to think about it is when you're first born, you don't have emotions. You can't attribute cause or meaning to anything that's happening to you. All you feel is, I'm satisfied, I'm happy, or something's wrong, I'm anxious, I need something. And so you start crying. And then over time, when you develop language, you learn to communicate what these affects mean. And that's when you develop emotional capacity. And art, a lot of the time it speaks emotionally, and at the same time it also speaks at the level below emotion. You need to work to turn it into emotion. It's a two-way process.
True. Personally, I feel like if you look historically at a lot of the troubled artists, they were typically innovators of pop art. Like looking at Nirvana, Kurt Cobain was very much like violently depressed and did not hide it at all in his music or in his interviews. And Nirvana completely changed music. Like even to this day, we are in a post-Nirvana world and we're seeing the repercussions directly of that. And I think it's something about the struggle of the artist that creates better art in the process.
That's where my opinion would get a little weird, because let's talk like David Bowie or Prince. I wouldn't necessarily count either of them as a like mentally having like all these issues. I know like they definitely did have like their stuff.
Well, Prince was also a drug addict.
Well, yeah.
He died of a drug overdose.
Yeah, he did.
That also factors in here. Like suicide is sort of the focal point of this discussion, but drug overdose is the same thing essentially for artists.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was going to say is that goes the difference between, I feel, yeah, definitely artists going through it make deeper art from what I've seen, at least in my opinion. Prince, I wouldn't say has like deep art. He just has phenomenal art. And I'm like, we're using art broadly, music. Prince makes good ass music and is a talented ass man in every regard. Kurt Cobain made, I feel, stuff that was like emotionally deeper. And that's where I feel like you have to have the separation of church and state here.
Yeah, I think there's depth to both of it. Deep is also a very strange metaphor and has a lot of meanings. But, I mean, Kurt Cobain wrote music about being pissed off in contemporary life, about not fitting in, about living in Seattle.
LMFAO.
Imagine.
The kinds of things that Prince was talking about with his music were very different. Like, Prince would write songs for other artists. He was not necessarily interested in telling people about his life with his music. And I think you can make things that produce a very deep effect in listeners, whether or not you're talking about your own life, as long as you're observant, as long as you're sensitive in a way that you can recognize the world around you.
Sublimation, right, is when we use art as an outlet, or when we use some other form of creation or some other activity to otherwise occupy our mind. When we're going through something, that doesn't necessarily mean that our art is going to be about ourselves. It doesn't necessarily mean that it's going to be more intimately focused. I know a lot of really fucked up artists who write some of the happiest shit. And I think Prince is a good example of that, actually. I think that he was probably fucked up in all kinds of ways, but he was also similarly able to extrapolate the feeling of joy that I think a lot of people get very desensitized to. I think sometimes the saddest people are also able to write about happiness the best.
Mm-hmm. It's just a person who sees the world with open eyes.
It's sensitivity. It's being sensitive to stimuli, right?
Yeah. If you see the world as it is, you probably will be very sad. But you see all the beauty in it as well.
For this topic, I look at a lot of examples of artists who used to do like drugs, and when they sobered up, like their art very drastically changed. And not necessarily in the sense that you might expect, like the experimental aspect or whatever that people associate with like drug use, but a lot of artists, they just make worse music when they're like happy and sober. One example I think of is like Dave Mustaine. Megadeth sucks, but like their early music was great because Dave Mustaine was on heroin and he quit
Damn.
When he sobered up and got happy, their music has just not been the same.
I was going to say, this sounds like the opposite of the Beatles.
I imagine you're a little more self-conscious when you sober up. You're kind of where you're all up here, you know, and you won't let yourself come down to here. And so I think once you come off of that, and you've been so comfortable up here, now it's like, here's like, oh, now I see that I'm naked, you know, because it hits a lot of people like that.
We've talked about this on the podcast before, is a lot of people use dissociative drugs to let go of their self-consciousness, to be able to express things that are very deep to them and put them out in a way that's very personal and very vulnerable. And sometimes it takes messing with your brain to be able to do that. And at the same time, I wonder how many of these artists have to go sober because of the pressures of the industry. And so they're becoming sober. It's wrapped up in a lot of expectations about you producing art. And those sorts of expectations are the thing that, if your mind is somewhere other than sensory stimulus, the kinds of things you're taking in and how you can communicate. Like, if everyone's expecting Dave Mustaine to keep doing Megadeth but better now that he's sober, obviously it's not going to sound good.
It's one of the pressures of tortured artists, I guess, is running into the creative block issue. I think another thing that drives the addiction and the overdoses is that you'll hear a lot of artists refer to this one time that they get blackout drunk and then they create a fucking banger. And sometimes it's getting into that creative flow and just hacking out a masterpiece in just a really short period of time. And then when people are struggling to get back to that, mental health issues happen. When finances and emotions are intertwined together, distress happens.
I'd say there's definitely the weird phenomenon of artists getting picked up when they're, I'm going to use cracked out as the just general term for doing a lot of different substances and stuff. And that's when they get picked up by a major thing or management. And the management guides them heavily and gets them to then fundamentally earn a profit. And then after that, it's like, well, okay, you can't stay cracked out for the next like 5 years. Like, we got this brand we got to keep up with. So you got to tone it back.
Well, then there's like examples like Motley Crue, where as part of their record deal, like, they were supplied liquor specifically because being violently drunk was their brand.
Mm-hmm.
And so like Motley Crue, like, I think at the peak of their alcoholism, like, each person in the band was consuming like 2 full bottles of Jack Daniels a day. And that was kind of what they were known for. Like, nowadays that they're sober, their music is better. I think most people would agree that it's worse, because their live performances back then were unruly. You never knew what they were going to say, what they were going to do. It fit the brand more than a bunch of sober dudes singing about doing drugs.
Yeah, it just doesn't fit right. And then once they're the biggest artists, or one of the biggest artists in the world, then you can't actually deal with that unruliness behind the scenes too much. And so then you need to try to get them to get better. And then you have that rebound of, yeah, okay, they might be in the studio on time, but like, the stuff they're writing when they're in the studio on time is trash, but it wasn't sustainable the way it was before. And just this weird like ping pong of balancing an artist's natural destructive habits that make it so they can get the art done, and what can actually make them functional as a successful artist.
My favorite advice comes from Keith Richards, who said that part of the reason he survived so long doing so many drugs is you need to balance your uppers, your downers, your psychedelics, your disassociatives. As long as you don't commit too hard to any one black hole of intoxicants, you can channel that creativity whenever you need to, but also maintain some degree of functionality.
That's honestly still some of the best advice.
Yeah. Beautifully spoken.
The Kurt Cobain thing. I grew up in Seattle, and that shit sucks. It's awful. You understand exactly why the dude shot himself easily.
There's a reason why some of the best grunge music came out of that one city.
There's a reason they had the flannels.
Right. I think that in art, again, when you're sort of forced to come to terms with some of the darkest parts of yourself, either for creation or for profit, especially when people get signed onto record deals, you know, that's their income. It's dependent on them being mentally unwell a lot of the time. I think that it brings a sense of comfortability and vulnerability with some very uncomfortable truths about ourselves. The world of grunge in Seattle is still very much alive. Like, Seattle's absolutely fucking awful, but in a way, Kurt Cobain and his like attention deficit, depressed lyrical writing brought beauty to the torture of that place.
Mm-hmm.
And just resonated.
I'll say, yeah, good impactful art in a lot of depressing areas is, I don't know if y'all have seen Avatar The Last Airbender, but it's like redirecting lightning. It's like, if you try to learn it out of nowhere, you're going to get fucked just royally. But if you like get trained and know how to do this, you can redirect lightning straight out somewhere else. So you're taking like the shitty situation and bad energies and just redirecting them elsewhere. But it's a very self-destructive process to try to redirect such energy.
There's this idea that the best art, or at least the most innovative art, the art that changes the world, always comes from a place of oppression in some form. And so we can think about the depressive environment of Seattle. We can think about slavery, the blues. That's where rock comes from, is profound oppression.
The Midwest.
Hip hop, punk, metal. These are all countercultural movements that on one hand are trying to speak truth to power in some sense, but it's also, if you think about how these radical and radically different forms of art came forth, it's because people were in a situation where they felt alienated. It's where they felt like they did not have access to the means to express themselves through the language that everyone else seemed to be fine expressing themselves through. And so they just needed to push art forward, channel whatever was weighing so heavily on them into something different.
And I feel like this kind of ties into the other topic of the monetization of celebrity death and the avoidance of mental health in the record industry, because I feel like in a lot of ways, kind of another form of oppression is like mental oppression. People who are suffering from debilitating mental illnesses, not only like not getting the help, but being actively encouraged to not get that help as a form of kind of generating that oppression to create that art.
This happens a lot with writers too. Ernest Hemingway and his fixation with death led ultimately to him actually dying because he had to sort of implicitly feel that way. He had to really tap into that.
He had PTSD and he writes in a way that's hyper focused on exactly what is happening, literally. You can't associate what's in front of you with any of your memories, because if your mind starts to wander, it will wander to bad places. It's the iceberg theory. There's a lot underneath the surface. All you need to say is what's on the surface, because if people want to get it, they'll get it. I really like Ernest Hemingway. He also writes like a drunk person. It's the linguistic equivalent of burying your trauma with alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and then that comes down to the publicists and anywhere else in the like label. You want the person to still like live as long as they can. It's just you don't want them to lose what makes them them, even though you know it could be self-destructive.
Sometimes them dying is more profitable than them slowly burning out and becoming irrelevant, because sometimes if that artist can die maybe before they cross that bell curve and they start to go down, that can be more profitable. Because I think of like a case of like Lil Peep. He was kind of unknown until he died. Like he was coming up, but then like posthumously he like exploded in popularity, and that was arguably what made him popular, was the fact that he died before he got to his like peak or his prime.
It also really does make me wonder about Motley Crue, if that was the intention, because they weren't like an innovative band. They were really, really good at what they did, which is write incredible pop rock songs. And I'm sure the industry knew that and knew that they didn't have that longevity. Mm-hmm. And so it's in their interest to fuel this downward spiral that would make them make better music in the short term, and it would make them ideally dead in the long term, mm-hmm. to maintain that image.
Right. Push to notoriety.
And I think for like most artists, regardless on how successful they are, their most records sold is going to be like the day after they die. Because when that artist dies, in a lot of cases, people want to rush out and buy the record or like buy the book that they put out. It almost creates like a scarcity mindset.
Once again, a lot of the appeal of art to a lot of people is a look into the artist's mind. But the thing is, most of the time, you don't know what the artist wanted to say. If the artist is alive and can contradict you, it doesn't make it as fun. If I'm looking at art or if I'm listening to music, I'll kind of have in the back of my mind what the person was trying to do, their intentions, or like what the process behind it was. But that's much less interesting than just the effect it has on me. And if the artist is dead, then you can go wild thinking about intentions, but all that matters anymore is what it does.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like having a book club and sitting there with the person who wrote the book. It's like, okay, why are we talking about it? You can just answer it for us if you really want.
And I feel like the death of the artist almost separates the art from humanity. Like, listening to artists that are currently alive, I'm like, yeah, this is cool. This is just like a guy telling about his life experiences. But hearing music from somebody who's dead, or like reading a story from somebody who's dead, it almost makes it that much more deep. Like listening to Nutshell by Alice in Chains, hearing him talk about like wanting to die because of fame, and then he ultimately killed himself because of that stuff, like it makes it hit that much harder versus if he were alive today. Like, obviously, it'd still be a depressing song about how fame fucked him up, but the fact that he died makes it hit that much harder.